Our sponsor for today's podcast is, of course, our friends over at Mono. Monocreators.com is where you can go and see their full lineup of gig bags and cases and pedal boards and everything else that they put out. I'm personally a fan of the Mono Vertigo guitar case. I keep my Telecaster in that all the time. It is so comfortable. It's so protective. It's got pockets for my laptop. It's pretty much everything I've ever wanted in a gig bag, and I am so happy to have it. So again, go to monocreators.com, and if you do reach out to them, tell them thank you for supporting the Fretboard Journal podcast. Hey gang, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Berlindy, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine, and we have a great episode for you today. I'm talking to one of my favorite young musicians, Jacob Miller, from down in Portland, Oregon. Jacob came up here to the Fretboard Journal offices. We had this chat with him. We also recorded him playing a couple of tunes, one of which is on fretboardjournal.com right now. Jacob has a new record out, his first full-length album called This New Home. It is on Mississippi Studios, and it comes out on June 6th. It comes out this week, so I hope everybody will check it out. In my head, he fills this sort of interesting niche between the music of like Blake Mills and J.D. McPherson. He somehow is able to get ferocious, amazing, unique guitar tones out of his amp, but he also has this sort of retro cool vibe, and we talk a little bit about that, and I kind of learn a little bit more about what makes him tick on this podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Again, his new record is called This New Home, and it is a great record. So what else can I tell you? We just got back from Nazareth, Pennsylvania, where I was at the Martin Guitar Factory for a few days. We recorded a couple podcasts there that I can't wait to share with you. And we also did a ton of videos and photos that will be showing up in the Fretboard Journal pages as well as on fretboardjournal.com very soon. It was a fun field trip. I don't take too many of those, sadly, but once a year it is nice to see how these guitars actually get made, and they were, it's an awesome place to visit if you are anywhere near Philadelphia or Nazareth, Pennsylvania, obviously. Get your butt over there. They do daily tours, and it'll open your eyes, that's for sure. What else can I tell you? Our new Amp Project, Amp Podcast, The Truth About Vintage Amps, continues to surprise us all with just how many of you are out there listening to it. So even if you don't think you care about amps, or the thought of an amp Q&A podcast sounds incredibly boring to you, give it a listen. Maybe start with episode one. We're up to 12 episodes now. Skip Simmons is the co-host alongside yours truly, but no one wants to hear me talk. They all want to hear Skip because Skip is a character. Skip knows more about amps than pretty much anyone I know, and he has helped so many people out on that podcast with not only amp purchases, but amp problems, life problems. I think he's kind of all taught us to be a little bit more DIY, which is kind of fun. So check that out. It's on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and everywhere else. What else? We got a ton of cool content on fretboardjournal.com right now, so check that out. As always, that is free for the taking. Anyone can go read all that stuff without having to do anything. If you want to support us in an even bigger way, perhaps the biggest way imaginable, we do have a program called the Fretboard Journal Insider, which is where the true fans of the Fretboard Journal can support us on a monthly basis and help us do all the cool things like this podcast. That's fretboardjournal.com/insider, and it's sort of where we are able to share the outtakes and the behind-the-scenes footage and all of the extra stuff that makes it doesn't make it into the Fretboard Journal magazine, which is turns out a lot of stuff, so... Fretboard Journal Insider is the name of that program. All right, without further ado, here is my chat with Jacob Miller. Again, the album is called This New Home, and I encourage everybody to check it out this week when it comes out. Jacob, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Absolutely, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming by. You sounded amazing.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going to get to the new record. We were just talking about dog sitting.
We were.
We don't need to keep talking about that. That was.
We've lived through that already.
Yeah, dogs aren't all they're always cut out to be. So you've played at a Fretboard Journal event for us, but I don't really know a lot of your backstory. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I guess so. I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin called Eden.
Okay.
It's about like 400 or 500 people, and my family is... been there pretty much since the town was founded in like late 1800s. So deep, deep Wisconsin roots.
Is this still like farming country? What is it?
It's just a small town. Like, there are farms completely surrounding the town, but okay. It's just like this small community town. Yeah. Pretty interesting. My family moved when I was in like a teenager, like 12 or 13, to Fond du Lac, which is the neighboring city and county.
Okay.
And so, yeah, but I spent most of my youth in Eden.
Going stir crazy, or were you able to channel?
A little bit. Like, we had a big yard and a couple acres to play around in, so we were always outside.
Okay.
And so I think it was better than living in the city, actually. And then I got that experience, or a slightly bigger town, when I was a little older and wanted to do things, you know, and socialize. So it felt like a good balance.
Your school had to be tiny.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I also grew up Catholic, which talk about original sin, but, yeah, I grew up, and went to Catholic schools basically until high school. And yeah, all the classes were, gosh, like, you know, 10 kids or something. Like, I think the elementary school I went to, the whole school was like 70 kids.
Yeah.
And that's like K through 12, or no, K through 8th or something like that. It's pretty wild.
Okay.
Very, very small.
You're not that old. You're a younger guy, so I'm guessing, like, was the internet your portal to good music
and like
life beyond?
Downloading music and that whole, I think around like the Napster days, that was when I was like 11 or 12.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, I went pretty deep in and discovered most of my music through that.
Yeah. And were you playing guitar at that point?
I started when I was 12. Yeah. Okay. So around the time that I started really investing in music and building like music catalogs and stuff, that was when I was playing guitar. But pretty typical like 12-year-old stuff, like learning riffs and that kind of thing. Not like delving into jazz or music theory or anything that heavy until, you know, a couple years later.
Got it. And then did you go straight from Wisconsin to Portland? Or
yeah. So I went to UWM in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for a semester, and then I just felt a little lost. And so my sister, who lives in Central Oregon, she was living in Portland at the time, and I visited, and I think for 10 days I visited Portland, and I just decided like, all right, I'm going to move out here. And I dropped out of college, and I think I worked like 3 jobs for 6 months, and then I took the train out and just kind of started over in Portland.
That's amazing.
I think I was 19 when I moved. So
wow.
Yeah.
And
one of the best decisions I ever made, absolutely.
And so you were pretty serious about music at that point, obviously.
Actually, like, it was completely like the biggest part of my life, but I wasn't pursuing it professionally in any means. But yeah, just kind of kept growing and becoming a bigger part of my whole, you know, thing that I do in the day to day. And the first couple of years I lived in Portland, I moved into this really fantastic house in Southeast on Alder and 18th with is all these people that I met through Craigslist, actually.
Okay.
It's like a housing thing. And it was a couple different kids that were like in their early 20s, and they were all blue. They were really into blues music and old Appalachian country music. And
very Portlandia.
Yes, very, very much so. But great. And they all like traveled and hitchhiked and went around the country and just like did that. That's what they did. It was really a cool environment to jump into at such a young age. And that's where I really started delving into most especially old jazz, like swing and ragtime from the teens and 20s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy. So what was the, not to sound parental, but what was the job plan when you moved to Portland? Oof, what were you doing?
None. Okay. I think I worked at, you know, random customer service jobs and that kind of thing. So just working just enough to cover my bills, and then completely the rest of the time was like 10 hours a day on the porch playing guitar and smoking cigarettes and just sitting in, you know, the sun when the summer was around and just playing on the porch.
And were these guys you were living with musicians as well? Or they were just there?
Yeah, all of them were musicians. This guy, Cliff Mitchell, he lives in Minneapolis now, I think, but he's a great finger picker. And he kind of was one of the first people I heard playing ragtime and like Travis picking, but like movements with the bass lines and a lot of like intricate picking kind of stuff. And then Lauren Kenny, she played banjo and guitar, and all, it was just a very musical house. Like, everyone was a songwriter, but very humble and sincere. Like, they were writing really good music, but it felt so down home and like just in the house. It was like this capsule of genuinity or something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and it was a really cool, especially, you know, having moved to Portland with no sense of direction except, like, I just like to explore the arts and get a bigger picture kind of on that. It was a great place for me to find myself in.
Yeah. And how many years have you been in Portland now?
Nine. Almost 10 in July, which is crazy.
Yeah. I think of you as a solo artist. You've obviously got this album coming out. Have you been in bands in Portland too along the way?
Yeah. So I've been doing the solo thing for about like a year and a half. Okay. And before I did that, I actually led a ragtime group for about 6 or 7 years. We were called Jacob Miller and the Bridge City Crooners. And it started out in the house I moved in after, that Alder house. And it was just always in the backyard, like washboard and resonator guitar and upright bass. And then eventually it was funny. It kind of went from like the teens blues, and we did all original music that I would write, but in that style of kind of old American music. And then we just like added a couple horn players, and eventually it was a full on swing jazz kind of group. And we did a lot of festivals and dances and stuff. And I did that for like about 6 years before kind of pulling the plug and wanting to try something different out.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
What was your ragtime guitar of choice?
That Archtop, actually, that Epiphone was, I really enjoyed playing that in the group. I had a National single cone resonator, the steel body, for a good chunk of that band. And then we busked a lot on the streets during street fairs. And, you know, when we were on tour, like if we didn't have a date, we'd just go on the street and play like a 6 to 7 piece band. And so it was quite the spectacle. It was a lot of fun. And we played probably for the first like 2 years, just half and half, busking and then venues and backyards and pretty much any kind of venue you can imagine.
All right. Do you remember the most lucrative day of busking in your life?
Oh my gosh. I think at Northwest Folklife Festival
here
in Seattle, actually. I haven't been in a couple years, like 4 years or something, but I remember, God, like 8 years ago or 7 years ago when one of the first years we ever went, we were shocked at like how lucrative the busking was. And I feel like in the more recent years I've heard that it's dwindled a little bit because I don't know if there's more acts or people want to spend less money or how it goes. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. But yeah, that the folk life experience was really fun and encouraging because that's kind of part of the whole vibe there, where there's a lot of street musicians and people just on the side of the street and sidewalks playing and it's performing.
Kind of counterintuitive, but I would think that the festival full of buskers, it would be kind of a diluted pool of tippers. Yeah, but
you'd think so.
You guys clearly brought the goods.
I think a big part of the reason that band did so well was because we were really involved in the swing dance scenes, kind of like coast to coast. And so when we would tour, we would set up intentional dates where there would be, you know, we're playing ballrooms or something like that. So there was kind of a draw for people that like that music and dance to it. Cause it seems like each city has their own pocket of like swing appreciators and dancers and stuff. So,
wow.
Which you wouldn't think, you know, like it's like a hidden thing, but then once you're in it, like in Portland, we used to play the Secret Society ballroom and it was always like 100 plus 150 people just packed full of dancers and that energy, like kind of collaborating where the dancers are reacting to what you're playing.
Sure.
And so there's like a neat kind of rapport that goes on between spectator and musician.
Yeah. Did you ever learn how to dance?
Very poorly. Okay. I know like a couple basic steps, but never my, number one priority.
That is such a weird little amazing scene. I mean,
it is.
Even when Deke Dickerson comes, there's always like four couples trying their damnedest in the crowd at the tractor.
Yeah, and it adds a cool energy to the performance. But yeah, that was really great. And it kind of reached this point where I felt like a little boxed or limited by the just the form of that music. Like since it's kind of throwback and really peppy and fun. Like there are ballads and things like that, but it didn't feel like I could write about really honest or personal things.
No.
It was much more like, hey, let's go dancing and, you know, drink some booze or something like that. Very throwback, which was kind of, the catalyst for me thinking to myself, like, I'd really like to write about, you know, more personal things that are going on in my life or I've dealt with and write about those. So that's kind of been what the last year's been for me.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's been really fulfilling in a different way than that band was.
So what has life in Portland been like? Do you have other jobs, or are you just kind of woodshedding and writing all the time?
Random things. Like this whole last year, I was traveling a lot. I went on tour in the Midwest in the fall. And then with recording and finishing the record, working towards booking lots of tours for this year, the summer and fall especially. But yeah, really random jobs. Like the spring I was in Central Oregon building out that apothecary shop.
Okay.
And then I came back to Portland this summer, and my friend who owns a barber shop was like, hey, can you help me build my second barber shop? And so random carpentry projects. Okay. And, you know, random odd jobs here and there to kind of, when I'm not gigging or working,
yeah,
pay the whatever bills I have at the time.
It's a good lesson for musicians that there's carpentry skills.
Yeah.
Always in demand.
You always have to have a side hustle.
Yeah.
It seems like, unless you're touring full time, which at the moment I'm not. So.
And in Portland, do you have like a music venue or a club where you can kind of work on these songs and kind of test the waters, so to speak?
Or kind of like a more casual kind of
setting? Yeah. Do you play one or two venues in particular or no?
There's one venue in Portland called Laurel Thirst Public House that I love. Have you ever heard of it?
It's a brewery, right? Or no?
No, it's a kind of like a dive bar, I guess. Okay. That feels a little disrespectful because I love the place so much,
yeah,
but it's,
sure,
you know, it's got a nice grit to it.
Yeah.
But it's on 28th and Gleason in Northeast Portland. I used to live a block away and my old band used to play there all the time. And, they're like one of the few remaining old Portland establishments where, okay, it's like gypsy jazz and country and bluegrass and blues and just like really high quality, like down home American music.
Yeah.
And there's always people there to support the artists. And it's, I think it's the bartenders or the community owns the bar itself.
Oh, cool.
Cause I think about a year ago, the people who own the property were trying to sell it and the whole community raised enough money to buy the building and keep it going. So,
cool.
That's definitely one spot that's a very comfortable place for many musicians in Portland, I think.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So you decided to make a solo record.
Yeah.
And tell me about how it came to be. Like, where'd you record it and what'd you use on it?
Yeah, so the record, it's called This New Home, and it kind of just is almost a time capsule, it feels like, from the transition from doing my old band to doing this now, which, you know, when you do something for such a long time, it feels like a definitive part of you, you,
sure,
know, like this character you played or something.
Yeah,
or
pretty much your whole adult life.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely. And so the record, I was right after the band I had disbanded the group and told, you know, my best buddies in the group, you know, I just kind of want to do something different. And they were all really supportive and pushed me forward. But it was still this weird transition for me. And so I had moved into this new house with my buddy Charlie, and he's a trumpet player and he travels quite a bit. And so when I moved into his house, I think the day I moved in, he's like, all right, I'm leaving for a month. I'll see you later. He was going to Europe or something to play. And he's like, yeah, I've got mics and gear and go for it if you want to play. And he had a drum set in the basement and a grand piano in the living room, yeah, and all this fun stuff just lying around and like two dozen trumpets.
Sure.
And yeah, I just started demoing out these songs and then I kind of liked how they sound, and it just evolved into this 10 song record that I wrote pretty much the entire time I was living at the house the first couple months. And I self-recorded it. I self-recorded it on an old computer I had and played all the instrumentation on the record.
GarageBand.
Yeah. Actually.
Right. Okay.
And then we converted it to Logic, and I worked with a good friend of mine in a studio in Portland, and kind of did some overdubs and some more multi-tracking, and then sent it to Nashville to this guy, Zachary Dyke, and he mixed it and just got it back like a week ago.
That's
so
rad.
Yeah, it feels really nice when you work on something for, you know, a year and or over that, and finally, you know, you're just excited to get the product in your hand and then get it out of your hand and push it out there.
Yeah.
So.
I've heard you play things that sound remind me of Blake Mills. I think you even have a Blake Mills cover, right?
I'm a big fan of his.
Today you were playing an Epiphone Spartan,
mm-hmm,
is that,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were mentioning that you had a National for a while. So what guitar was on the record, and how many, you know, what do you turn to for songwriting?
Honestly, whatever's around. Like if I'm writing, I I think it's fun to play maybe instruments you're less familiar with when you're writing, because they challenge you in different ways, or maybe approach it in a different way than you would something you're really used to. Yeah, kind of whatever's lying around. The record I wrote mostly on my Fender Jazzmaster, which I had gotten right when my old band split. So it felt like this new
statement.
Yeah, like this new piece, essentially. Yeah. You just kind of want to restart in a totally, like, not a mask, but, you know, like putting something new on.
Sure.
And I was, you know, just the ease of playing in electric after playing a National and the Archtop for so long. It just felt easy and fun and can do all this new and different stuff. But as I mentioned earlier when we were doing the videos, the Archtop is kind of my baby. I really love that guitar. It's just got like so much history in it. It's like an 80-year-old guitar and feels great. So I think that's the one for sure.
And can you rehash the story of how that guitar came to
your
life?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll try to nutshell it. So I had bought this I was on a quest to find a guitar similar to an L5, but I was nowhere near the budget of buying an L5, of course, being a broke musician. And so I had bought this Gibson, I think it was like a 65 or a 67 Archtop, like a really light colored Sunburst, mm-hmm. one of the later ones. And it had this neck damage where it looked like it had almost been split and like not glued back together, but it looked pretty crude.
Okay.
And I had gotten it for, you know, a really reasonable price at this shop in Portland, and I was so excited about it. And then when I played it at the shop and it felt fine, and then when I got it home, it just was super difficult to play, and I just found myself leaving it on the shelf. And so I continued my quest of finding the perfect Archtop, and I found this Epiphone, the Spartan, on Craigslist, and this guy had it for sale for like $1,400 or $1,500, was just a little bit out of my price range. And so I had reached out to him and asked if I could sell him the Gibson, cause he turned around guitars, and he said, no, man, like there's no way I can resell that Gibson with the neck the way it is. And so, okay. And then I think it was about 3 months later, randomly, I was wondering, oh, I wonder if, you know, there's another one that I could buy on Craigslist. So I searched, and that guy who had posted the Spartan had reposted it that day, the same morning that I had randomly checked, and I hadn't looked for 3 months, for like $10.50. And so that day I posted the Gibson, which I don't know why I hadn't done it sooner, but I sold it for $10.50, which is $200 more than I bought it for. And then I bought the Epiphone afterwards. And Gibson, it feels like it was meant to be.
Well, sure. Yeah. And Gibsons keep their value even when they aren't as playable as.
Yeah. And that thing, yeah, there's just something special about it. I really like that guitar. And yeah, I had mentioned earlier a couple months after I had bought the Epiphone, the guy, a random number, messaged me and said, hey, I sold you that guitar and I've never regretted selling one before, but if you ever sell that, please let me buy it back from you. I totally regret giving it to you. I was like, hey, you had two times you could have done that. So.
Yeah, yeah. Fate intervened.
Yeah.
You posted the day I was looking.
It did really feel serendipitous.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, that one's going to stick around for sure.
And then your pedal board? What's
yeah,
on there?
It's really simple. I had never really used pedals before I got the Jazzmaster last year, because it was always just like a DI with the Archtop.
Sure.
But I've just got a standard volume pedal that I use for kind of like pedal steel swells. I've got a Strymon Flint for mm-hmm. Strymon reverb, and then I got a Hudson Broadcast for an overdrive pedal.
Okay.
Which, I heard at the gig that I played for Fretboard.
Yeah.
What was the name of the guitarist that won the guitar?
Ariel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His tone was so great that day. And I asked, and I was like, that overdrive is so crunchy, but not too much. And I had asked him and he told me what it was. And, I called Hudson that makes it. It's the Broadcast pedal, and they're out of the UK.
Okay.
And they only sell to like 3 or 4 shops in the States.
Oh, wow.
And I went into Strum guitar in Portland after calling all these shops, seeing if they had it, and they didn't. Then they'd call me when they got it. And kind of similar to the guitar, the Archtop, actually, I walked in this guitar shop, Strum, in Portland to get my Jazzmaster set up. And they had one in the window. And I was like, Michael, the guy who owns the shop, Michael, where did you get that? Like, I was just on the phone for like 2 hours today trying to find one. And he's like, it just came in 15 minutes ago.
Wow.
And
you got the magic touch.
I couldn't believe it. And I told him, I was like, can I buy it from you? And he's like, I actually have it reserved for one of my friends, but yes, I'll sell it to you and make my friend obsessed. So he sold it to me that day.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty lucky. So yeah, that's my whole pedal setup.
And what about amp wise?
I have a 68 reissue Fender Princeton that I play, but I didn't drag it up on the bus from Portland this morning.
You need to. So we have amps here.
Yeah. I'm glad. Yeah, carrying the guitar up on the bus was enough worrisome, you know.
Yeah.
So.
So you got the record coming out in June.
Mm-hmm, June 6th. Yeah.
June 6th. You're gonna be touring. You're gonna be touring solo. What are you gonna do?
Yeah. So I'm gonna be doing a West Coast tour in June. And the first couple dates I'll be doing with a trio that I've been playing with. We're playing at the Doug Fir Lounge this Friday, which is the 8th, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's like to celebrate the single release that we did yesterday of the first single off the record, Cut My Teeth. But in June we'll do 3-week West Coast tour, and that'll just be me and a drummer, similar to the show we played. Same guy, Daniel Rossi.
Cool.
Great drummer. And it'll be me and him and this guy, Joshua Thomas, who's another singer-songwriter. And then in August, I'll be doing the Midwest for like about a month and a half. And then I'm going to Europe for 8 weeks in the fall to tour the record.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Can't wait.
Yeah, I'm really excited. It's going to be a good time.
Great. Thank you so much for coming here, Jacob.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.